Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man, Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face Off on WGN Radio. That's right. You're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face Off. I am Rich Lenkoff. I am one of the co-hosts. Tina Martini is conflicted today, unfortunately, so it's just me. We've also got Joe Brain, who will maybe joining us shortly. He is having some traffic issues here in the great city of Chicago, so we might have another fill-in, Joey Christopoulos, join us. But all that being said, we're really grateful to have Dan Novak, First Amendment lawyer and host of the brand-new podcast Slandertown, joining us today to talk about the Johnny Depp versus Amber Heard trial. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you and I are both watching Twitter. We don't see the jury back yet. They've been deliberating all day today, presumably after a long holiday weekend. Do you think that this is standard kind of cliche question to all legal analysts when you got a jury, a high-profile jury, a long deliberation or short deliberation? What are we looking at, and who does that favor? This is a little harder case because we got countersuits. Both are suing each other for defamation. So I don't think it's as clear as you would normally answer, but let's get your take on the deliberation time.
I'm going to go out on a limb and predict long, because there's just so much evidence in this case flowing in both directions. And there's a number of incidents that the jury will want to look at carefully and weigh the evidence for or rebutting whether or not those incidents took place. The only reason to kind of have a short turnaround would be if the jury just concludes right off the bat that one side is just completely full of it and they don't care to examine their claims. And I think that would be fairly extreme given how much evidence we're looking at, 6 weeks of evidence here.
Yeah. Our next, one of our guests later will be talking about this as well, Dina Dahl. She, made a really interesting point that I was reading over the weekend. You know, she gave the jury way more credit than I think a lot of people do. And she said the jury in these kind of high profile cases really do listen to the evidence. They really try to put aside the external noise. In this case, that's really hard. There's so much external noise. It's probably, the most covered trial in American history. And you might think OJ was first. OJ, it was way before the Twitter era, the TikTok era. There are so many TikTok videos already about this that I think you could argue this is the most covered trial in American history. So given all that, do you think the jury is really going to dive into the specifics of defamation and the cause of action for defamation? Or are they just listening to all the extraneous stuff and sort of thinking, well, these are two Hollywood actors and who do I like more, right? Hopefully that's not it, but what's the reality of what's going on in that box?
It's really hard because, I take the jury at face value, and to get through to this point, they had to in voir dire say, I don't have a bias here that conflicts in one direction or the other. I'm not a massive Pirates of the Caribbean fan such that I could never see Johnny Depp, be spoken of in this way. I'm not a massive Aquaman fan, in favor of Amber Heard. That being said, we're all aware that they're actors. And so that when they're on the stand that they're acting. They could be telling the truth and acting. A lot of acting is finding truth, but it could also be lies. And so I just don't know how you shake that, that sort of meta layer that is just so much more apparent, because these are the types of people that are at the tops of their profession. And if they want you to believe something's not true, I would think that they have a better ability to do that than I could. Sure, as lawyers, we try to be zealous advocates for our clients, but I never found myself to be a terribly convincing liar. So I think that's a challenge for them, and they want to take it seriously. There's no evidence that they've been falling asleep or anything like that. There's been some slow parts, like any trial. It's hard to maintain that stamina for 6 weeks, but it's been colorful at parts. We've seen certainly moments where there was levity and laughter. There's some cringe moments too. There's some dark moments. So I think they've kind of, it would be hard not to be invested in this in a way that's compared to a very dry technical case about trade secrets or something.
Yeah, Dan, I know you've done some deep dives online into a lot of the intricacies of the trial, which I find fascinating, and I was glued. I just got to say, I already missed this trial because I was glued as a legal analyst, as a junkie of this kind of stuff, as a law geek. I was glued to every minute, and I'm really glad to see someone else like you dive into a lot of the small details, like, you know, the eye contact that Amber Heard was making with the jury. It was really distracting in one way. In another way, I thought she was really well coached, you know. And for our listeners, you know, during Amber Heard's testimony, she would look directly at the jury who was seated to her right. And at one point, you know, Camille Vasquez, who was Johnny Depp's lead lawyer, told her, like, please do not testify directly to the jury if there's no question pending. What did you make of that and her overall demeanor? And coupled with that, what do you think of the overwhelming derision that Amber Heard seems to be facing online, given, again, what I thought was a pretty compelling piece of testimony, aside from some obvious lack of credibility, which I think is to be expected in any case that goes on this long? That's the longest compound question in history, but give it a shot.
I was fascinated by their respective approaches here, because on the one hand, this is Johnny Depp's case, although that's not fully true because she countersued. And we have this scenario where a jury's asked to answer two questions that are sort of right up to the line of each other, but don't fully overlap. Is it more likely than not that Amber Heard lied when she accused, if you credit that op-ed as accusing Johnny Depp of domestic violence, which I think is a reasonable reading of it, did she lie when she did that? More likely than not lie, but she is countersuing, and did Depp's lawyer more likely than not lie when he said that this whole thing was a hoax? So in theory, they could actually come to like a split decision where the jury just doesn't think either side is more credible than the other. And Johnny Depp loses his claim because it's his burden to prove the lie on her side. And she loses her claim because it's her burden to prove his lie. I don't see that happening, but I keep thinking about that because they both have equivalent burdens for their version of events. I think that both parties have a completely plausible story to tell. So that's what makes this so hard, is that if Amber Heard is telling the truth, the things that she has been sort of impeached for in terms of character or in terms of undermining certain timelines or how the evidence sort of falls, you could overlook it if you just fundamentally believe her. On the other hand, if she did make this up, everything that Johnny Depp has done is completely, predictable. This is what you would do if you were trying to clear your name. So I have tried to sort of practice some humility, and I don't believe I can tell what really happened. So I'm trying to look at the evidence the way that a jury is supposed to and be open to both possibilities. That being said, they have very different styles. And so Johnny Depp at times was kind of somber, but also was funny. Like had more than one sort of applause line. There's those kind of highlight packages with the hearsay objections that he sort of was anticipating at various moments. Whereas Heard was, I mean, I thought she was extremely combative. But if you were being put through a situation where not only were you abused, but then you have this legal process, which if her allegations are true, is another form of abuse against her, why wouldn't you act angry at that line of questioning? Camille Vasquez, Johnny Depp's attorney, was extremely aggressive. And I have to think that the fact that she, as the woman on that legal team, drew Heard as a witness, that has to be intentional to me, because I can't imagine Ben Chu doing those same questions. It would just look, I just think the optics would be really challenging. So but those colloquies they got progressively nastier. And that doesn't mean on Heard's end exclusively. I thought that Vasquez gave as good as she got, and it started to just look like posturing on both sides. So I thought that it was logical, if you were trying to win this case as Heard, that you would be pissed off. That's what you want to show the jury, is that I'm going through a second form of abuse here. But if the jury is looking at this in a very dry way and wants to just evaluate the photographs and the testimony of the experts, then the emotion is not helpful to me.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff is so fascinating. I wish we had. I mean, we could literally talk about this for hours because it's so interesting. But we've got a break here. One last question. We'll just ask you the impossible one word answer on two questions. Number one, what day do we see a verdict? And number two, who wins? And again, we know that the one loss is kind of a fungible answer here, but we're going to put you on the spot.
Okay. Date of verdict. I'm going to say Friday. That would give them 3 days and change from now to get through it. Because I think this is strong. Let's not get in through the, come out through the weekend and have to do this again. They already had the long weekend, which must be so disruptive to their deliberation. But I think that's optimistic. And then who wins? I've watched a lot of this case. I have found that I found on a strategic level, I found myself agreeing more with some of the choices that Depp's team made. And I think if I had to bet, but I'm only saying 51%, I think he has a 51% chance of winning. But I do believe this is truly a toss-up.
Dan Novak, check out his podcast, Slander Town, wherever you consume podcasts. Dan, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Anytime. Thank you.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off. We've got with us today University of Dayton Dean and Professor of Law at the School of Law, the University of Dayton, Andrew Strauss. Dean, welcome to Legal Face-Off.
Thanks very much, Rich. Good to be here.
So on a couple of weeks ago, the American Bar Association voted to seek public comment on a proposal eliminating the mandatory testing requirement for law school admissions, throwing the fate of the infamous, some would say, LSAT exam, I remember it well when I took it, into question. What are your feelings about whether LSAT should continue to be the standard by which law schools judge, or at least partially judge, how they admit students?
Well, I would say, Rich, that the LSAT has certain advantages, but I don't think that it should be mandated that every law school has to use either the LSAT or the current standard is they have to use either the LSAT or the GRE, or the burden is on them to find another test that they would use. And I think opening it up to a lot more diversity of possibilities really makes sense. There's about 200 law schools in the United States, and they're tremendous laboratories for experimentation. I think the ABA really does best when it tries to mandate results that every law school creates, brings in diverse classes of professionals who it trains to be analytical thinkers and competent and ethical lawyers, rather than getting into the weeds on telling us exactly how to do that. So I think there's some real advantages to leaving it open to law schools to decide and figure out the best way to achieve those goals.
Dean, why do you think the LSAT does not lend itself to that diversity that is so valuable to you and your peers in evaluating incoming students?
Well, I'm not saying it. I didn't say that it doesn't lend itself to that diversity, but just that law schools should be able to decide for themselves what the best way of achieving those goals are. I do think there's some question about LSAT in this regard. As you know, Rich, the movement in undergraduate education since the pandemic has been to go test optional, or in some cases, even test blind. And so this is sort of an extension of what's been going on in the undergraduate space. And there has been a lot of discussion that tests, the college entrance tests, are detrimental to diversity. The discussion among law schools has been much more nuanced and complex around this, I would say. The LSAT, actually, when it was originally introduced, was introduced with the idea that there was discrimination at that time. This is in the immediate post-World War II period, against Catholic and Jews, and that this would create a standard that would be objective and could actually help increase diversity. More recently, diversity admissions professionals in 2018 there was a similar proposal to do away with a mandatory testing requirement. And it was actually diversity admissions professionals that rallied in support of the LSAT at that time. And the Law School Admissions Council, which runs the LSAT, has argued that it actually increases diversity. I think it's a complicated question. It is true that oftentimes students of color, and for that matter, many times majority students who come from poor backgrounds don't have the preparation and don't do as well on the LSAT. They can't afford tutoring, and sometimes their educational backgrounds haven't given them the same preparation. Law schools have been able to be somewhat holistic in the way they've used the LSAT and haven't had to just rely on the LSAT. I would just sort of conclude this by saying, in the wake of the impending Supreme Court cases, the Harvard and North Carolina cases, which are challenging universities' ability to use race as a factor in admissions, the LSAT could end up really straitjacketing law schools, that they have to only take people with the same level of LSAT scores. So it could be more problematic from a diversity perspective going forward.
Dean, the last question we have time for on this really interesting issue is, we've covered the story before that more than ever, students both on an undergraduate level and in law school are leaving their educational careers with huge amounts of debt, right? I mean, you could be leaving law school alone with $150,000 or $200,000 in debt that we, as we know, is almost impossible to really pay off in your lifetime. We've seen on the political front lots of calls to wipe out college debt. I don't think you could talk about this issue of doing away with or at least decreasing the value of the LSAT exam without talking about that piece as well. So do you see minimizing the value of the LSAT as a benefit or as an impediment to those who are considering whether to spend that kind of money on law school? On the one hand, you would think that, well, if you really are serious about taking on that amount of debt, you should at least create that LSAT prep and test fee as a bit of a barrier to those who would otherwise just, you know, take on that debt without considering it. That's a really long question, but I think you know where I'm going with that.
Sure, Rich. And again, I would revert back to really my first answer, that we do want, I think, in law schools, students that are very serious about wanting to become lawyers, to practice law. Law school is hard. I mean, we hear that all the time from our students. I'm sure you remember the experience yourself. And people have to have the desire to do it and to stick with it. I don't think, though, the only way of sort of testing that desire, if you will, is for students to have to take the LSAT. I think, again, that we're going to benefit from law schools being more able to rely on a variety of factors to determine the commitment of students to law school, including interviews, including looking at their undergraduate records, including perhaps taking pre-law courses, boot camps, all sorts of things that they can do. And again, law schools can continue under the proposal to use the LSAT. So I don't see that as a real problem going forward.
University of Dayton School of Law, Dean Andrew Strauss, thanks so much for joining us on Legal Faceoff today, and good luck to the Flyers this upcoming athletic season.
Thanks very much, Rich.
We all know the legal world is complex and high pressured. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all of your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com.
Moving on with Legal Face-Off, we're also privileged to have someone who is very much in demand right now. In fact, He's joining us right off a movie set with a A-list director. Scott Reitz is with International Tactical Training Seminars. He's a 30-year veteran of the L.A. Police Department. He was an adjunct professor for the U.S. Department of Energy's SRT-3 program. His podcast is called With Deadly Force, and his most recent book is The Art of Modern Gunfighting. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Rich.
Obviously, we're following this story in Uvalde, and it's been about a week since this tragic shooting. You are one of the nation's foremost experts in active shooting training. What went wrong with the police response here in Texas?
Well, a lot. The list is going to be endless once the FBI comes out or anybody comes out with a detailed investigation. But there were a lot of mistakes, missteps that were made. The timeline is absolutely egregious on when the officers not only responded initially, failing to engage with the suspect, but, getting in there right away. I think it was 5 to 6 911 calls were made when officers were on scene from the young children that were inside asking the police to come in and help them. And to be quite honest, it somewhat infuriates me that somebody didn't just take over. And the individual who was in charge who made that decision, from what I have seen so far, his experience is extremely limited in anything tactical. I'm sorry. That's just the way it is.
So we know from what we hear, at least preliminarily, is that part of the decision was made because he thought that the shooter was locked in the classroom and was alone. It seems strange that he would think that when the police were in the hallway, at least a dozen or so were in the hallway and getting these 911 calls and presumably hearing what's going on. It's a relatively small school. How do you think there could be that much confusion? Understanding, of course, that, it's easy to sit here and say what should have been done in the fog of what's happening on the ground. That's got to be incredibly stressful. But to your point, you're trained for this, so it seems strange that that kind of mistake would be made, confusing an active shooter who had been shooting within minutes of entering the classroom with someone who was trapped, trapped in.
Well, you have, obviously numerous shots fired. You have parents outside, parents screaming.
Right.
You have children inside. You have all those phone calls coming in. That's not a hostile situation. That's an active shooter. Irrespective of the fact that the suspect hadn't fired any shots, maybe for several minutes. I don't know what the timeline is or if they could hear anything in terms of auditorially. But, if the suspect has a weapons malfunction or he's reloading or whatever, you still have to get in there. You have to get in there right away. There are a number of things they could have done if you're on the scene. They have a 28-man department. They have 9 people on their SWAT team. That was as of 2 years ago. I saw a photo of it. It's okay, but not all SWAT teams are the same. Not all police departments are the same. And there is no logical explanation why anybody, a commander or anybody on scene, incident commander, would not treat this as an active shooter in progress. You have, it's just, there are no words at this point. I'm sorry.
Scott, we know from some of the accounts that are coming out that there is definitely some communication issues on the ground, right? And eventually the U.S. Border Patrol, which is obviously a federal agency, took over and decided to breach. In these kind of situations, and you've been a veteran of so many of them, what is it like on the ground? It's got to be, of course, difficult to maintain a chain of command. It's got to be difficult communicating, but that's so important in these situations more than ever to have a clear chain of command and to know who's in charge. It seems like on the ground, there wasn't that clear direction, and that led to, at least partially, what we're seeing now.
Well, we have taught many, many active shooter classes going well past the last 20 years. We just finished a class in Minnesota 2.5 weeks ago, came back out here. One of the things that I tell the officers is I want you to remember this. If you were watching a live feed and your children are in that, go to Virginia Tech or and certainly this one's going to be their paradigm model of what not to do. But if you're watching a live feed, I'm standing outside, I'm armed, even if all I have is a handgun and standard body armor, which all police officers wear now, in uniform, and you have kids inside, your children are inside that classroom. Do you want me to stand and wait for backup, or do you want me to go in right away? And universally, every single officer says, no, I'm going in. And I told the group that I just trained, I said, you may be going in by yourself. You may have to hazard yourself. And it is totally predicated on the seriousness and devotion that you take your oath, that you swear, you know, when you put on that badge that, you know, you're out there to help people that can't help themselves, especially in a situation where you have young children such as this. Anybody who is on the first person on scene, that becomes the incident commander. I could care less about rank. Rank means absolutely nothing. It does not denote expertise in any way, shape, or form, knowledge or background, you know, training. It means nothing. It's the first person that is on scene. That's the incident commander. If I had been there, there's no way you could have held me back from breaching that door. If you get laced up, you get shot, that's too bad. That's just part and parcel of what you do. They could have commandeered an 18-wheeler. They have police cars. Commandeer an 18-wheeler, and you could literally run into the side of the building where the windows are, breach it, have an entry team behind that. If the hallways are wide enough, like they are in some, and I don't know, but I know in some high schools, the hallways are wide enough, you can drive a car in there and breach the door with a vehicle or breach the wall. There are any number of things. It's infuriating that people would stand out there. And how do you get that many officers not to override this individual and just say, you know, this is ridiculous. I'm going. I don't get it.
My last question here on Legal Face-Off is, you know, obviously the victims' families are going through hell and will forever go through hell. We've covered these stories, unfortunately, extensively over the course of 8 years here on Legal Face-Off, talked to a lot of victims' families. What we haven't talked about so much is how the officers deal with it. Of course, you know, at the end of the day, you know, this police chief, Peter Arredondo, he carries a lot of responsibility. But talk to us a little bit about what he's dealing with, what the officers are dealing with. You know, these are still human beings, and you could certainly assign responsibility and learn from what they should have done differently. But obviously very difficult for them to live with these decisions for the rest of their lives. As a former police officer, can you talk to us a little bit about what they'll be dealing with?
I think they're going to have a real hard go of it. I would, if I was in that situation. I probably wouldn't have acted in the same manner as they did. I just would have superseded everybody and gone. That's just me. And I know my partners, and I worked in SWAT for 10 years in Metro on LAPD. you're going. Whether or not you're coming in behind me or not, inconsequential to me. I'm moving in. I think they're going to have a hard time, and there's going to be a lot of criticism leveled. It's I do not envy these individuals. I don't envy being in their shoes. And emotionally, I think it's going to be very difficult for them, you know, to deal with the aftermath and the fallout. And
you think there's any criminal liability here?
I don't think there's criminal. I think there's going to be culpability in the part of ineptitude, negligence. You know, that's pretty much how these people are going to probably be pressed. That's what I would imagine if you look at the lawsuit.
That's Scott Reach from internationaltactical.com. The podcast is With Deadly Force. It's an excellent podcast. And the latest book is The Art of Modern Gunfighting. Scott, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Rich, thank you very much for having me. I look forward to being on the future if you need me.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubble and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers and Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome into the Legal Grab Bag Face-Off segment here on the Legal Face-Off podcast. I'm Joe Brand. Let's get to our two guests for the Legal Grab Bag segment, with Dina Dahl starting as our legal analyst for the Law and Crime Network, also co-founder of Dahl, Amir, and Ely Practice. And you can also find her on TikTok at AskDinaDahl. Dina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Jeremy Evans, founder of California Sports Lawyer and host of the Believe in Sports Law Network with Jeremy Evans. Jeremy, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Rich, we're going to start off with the most recent hearings of the Johnny Depp Amber Heard course that we've been following for quite some time now.
Yeah, the jury's out. They are literally deliberating now. We thought we might hear something Friday. That was a little optimistic. They took the long weekend, and now they are deliberating. Dina, you know, in a typical case, you might apply the sort of cliche jury being out for a long time helps one side or the other. This case is a little more gray because their counts are suing each other. So there's not really one clear winner or loser. What's your early impression of what's going on really day one and a half, maybe, of deliberations?
You know, we just actually got a jury question not that long ago, which was interesting.
Breaking news.
I think it was a little bit revealing on the timing, actually, because they asked whether or not the headline is a statement for defamatory purposes or if it's the whole article. Now, we know there's six different statements at issue. Johnny Depp is alleging three of them defame him. Amber Heard is alleging three of them defame her. The headline is the very first statement in that verdict form. So I think they're at the very beginning here.
So it'll be a long process, probably. You know, we heard weeks of testimony. I know you said from listening to an interview you gave on Canadian TV over the weekend, or maybe on Friday, that juries, you know, maybe counter to what we often think, even as veteran litigants, the juries actually do pay really, you know, close attention to the evidence in these cases, even though there's weeks and weeks of testimony and many different witnesses, that you think in this case they really are going to listen to the evidence and testimony, not maybe be so wowed by the celebrity status and all the extraneous noise. Why do you think that?
I think because we've seen time and time again, juries, you know, we can ask jurors questions after they deliver a verdict, and they usually come to that same legal issue that we've all been grappling with. And here, while of course these are two major celebrities, they've been watching them for 6 weeks. So I think maybe that shine has kind of worn off a little bit to them. They probably can evaluate it at this point. And they're instructed really to not, they're not supposed to come to their verdict with any sympathy, you know, with any kind of prejudice or bias. And I think that jurors do take that oath seriously and have proved that they are very good at looking at the evidence. And I think that question was a very thoughtful question. They really want to get it right, it sounds like. They're really clarifying, you know, is it a statement? Is it the article? It shows how careful they're being.
Jeremy, you deal with a lot of high-profile cases, a lot of high-profile plaintiffs against a lot of your clients. You know, in this case, I called it earlier in our show today, the most covered trial in American history. I think it is, given the TikTok, Twitter era we are in now, right? The O.J. Simpson trial was incredibly well covered, but there was not the internet coverage to the extent that we have now. There wasn't social media. So given that, and given the overwhelming derision that Amber Heard is facing on TikTok especially, but all across social media, I wonder if that translates to inside that jury room. In other words, do you think that the society in general, at least as it's represented on social media, is going to correlate to how those seven people are looking at this case? Or do you really think that they are really sort of in a bubble and not having maybe the same thought processes as the rest of the world seemingly has in overwhelmingly favoring Johnny Depp?
That's such an important question. And I love what Dina had said and shared too. And I think I would make two points on that. I think the first is that the jury will be influenced by that only insofar as the people who are on social media are basically our peers as well. So when you get a jury of your peers, right? So if people in the public that are, you know, watching it on TV are affected by it and they have comments on it or thoughts on it, the jury probably has those same thoughts. Whether they actually use that in their analysis is probably unlikely. They're going to have to follow the jury instructions, as Dina had said. But I think the other point that I would make is that, you know, ultimately, when folks are sort of looking at some of the evidence, I mean, you know, maybe you might be influenced by, you know, public opinion. I mean, the reality of it is you can't ignore it. It's out there. You know, you can't force jurors not to look at their phones or to pay attention to the news. But I would say that, you know, if the jury is, you know, of public opinion is weighed pretty heavily in favor of Depp, there might be something to that. And I would say from watching from the sidelines, you know, there's been a lot of evidence presented. I think ultimately it's just a sad situation overall that their marriage had to be, you know, published, you know, here in public. But I guess to the question, I don't think it's going to have much of an effect other than it would have an effect on you, you know, listening to it and how you might form an opinion about it. But I think the jury instructions and the way that the judge has handled this trial, it'll come down to the evidence at play.
Dina, before we move on, just last question on this topic. Johnny Depp, there's video of him over the weekend playing guitar with Jeff Beck in London. I mean, many have criticized Johnny Depp's demeanor during the whole trial as, you know, pretty aloof and snickering a lot, doodling, not making eye contact with Amber Heard, etc. You know, the jury is probably not picking up on this video. Maybe they are, probably not, though, if they're following instructions. What do you make of sort of how Johnny Depp is now acting as the trial is in the jury stage?
So his supporters are definitely kind of rejoicing in this. They see it as his moment to process everything. He loves his music. But as a lawyer, I would have advised him against doing that, because the point is that the jury is still stuck working on his case. They want to go home. They want to do their hobbies. They want to see their family. And if he is essentially asking this jury to show up and put in these really long hours, I think that was in poor taste, having him play these concerts until at least just wait for the verdict to come in.
The world is still pretty shook after the mass shooting in Uvalde, Texas. And Rich, President Joe Biden with some pretty strong vows after visiting the area.
Predictably right. I mean, the president, you know, over the weekend on Sunday, him and the first lady were in Texas, and he came out and said, you know, we will go forward with gun control. But the question, I think, for the panel is, how realistic is that, right? We've seen time and time again that in the wake of these shootings, there is a period where everyone is mobilized to enact more strict gun legislation, and that, you know, quickly goes away. And, you know, every single time, especially when there's shootings involving elementary students, it seems to be this is the final straw. And this is finally the end of this, and will force legislators to enact more strict gun regulation. We've all seen the studies of other countries, many of whom who have, you know, way longer and, you know, longer traditions of gun ownership, but don't have this kind of issue. And we've seen how they deal with it legislatively. So what do we think, Jeremy? Do you think there is finally the impetus to get that 60-person majority in the Senate to pass gun control? Or do you think fairly soon this will evaporate and will be on to the next shooting, unfortunately?
Well, I think, unfortunately, from the standpoint of forgetting sort of our history and forgetting our, you know, some of these things that happen across the country and really across the globe with regard to shootings, it's so unfortunate, especially in this circumstance with, you know, with the children. I think that I don't think Congress is going to pass some national legislation unless somehow in the midterms a supermajority was brought in, or I just don't think that we're going to see that. Now, what I do think is going to happen is we're going to have states, particularly California and maybe some of the more blue, and I would say even more, maybe some of the red states as well, or purple states, you know, might see more legislation towards, you know, regulating gun laws and background checks and, you know, that sort of thing. But I think anytime, you know, what we've seen time and time again with the Supreme Court, though, too, is that anytime a state comes forward with some sort of regulation, it's eventually challenged in court and eventually overturned as unconstitutional because of the Second Amendment. So I think states will probably have a bigger role in this than the federal government.
Dina, in some ways, that's an interesting point, Jeremy. In some ways, though, Dina, I was thinking about this over the weekend, and in some ways, this shooting actually emboldens opponents of gun control, because I've heard this from a couple of Second Amendment advocates already, that the old idea that you know, the Second Amendment lobby would say that the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Well, in this case, as we just talked about with another expert, we had at least 11 or 12 good guys with guns just steps away from the bad guy with a gun. And that didn't solve the problem. So in some ways, this only emboldens that argument that it doesn't matter if, you know, someone who's hell bent on shooting is going to do their will.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, for me, the argument, you know, that the Second Amendment gives somebody a right to a gun is kind of where the NRA and proponents kind of come from, that place. Mm-hmm. And it seems hard to attack it. But we know that that was not the case until 2008 in the Supreme Court case Heller that Justice Scalia wrote. And that was the first time the Supreme Court interpreted the Second Amendment as having an individual right to bear arms. And I think that needs to become part of the larger conversation to realize that this isn't something that's been part of our history for, you know, since the inception. And not only that, but it's that Supreme Court case, which, you know, that was a 5-4 decision. You know, now we have more conservative justices. It's going, you know, if this issue comes up, it's probably going to be even stronger. And a lot of those state legislations that probably will get passed are going to be fought now at the Supreme Court and may very well get overturned because of this stricter review on this Second Amendment and what kind of regulations you can do on now a constitutional right for you, not just bearing arms in the context of a militia, but you to bear arms. And I think, unfortunately, even if we pass a lot of regulations, a lot of those are going to be fought. And with this Supreme Court, they may very well get overturned.
Which Deshaun Watson, quarterback of the Cleveland Browns, wouldn't go on in the HBO interview, but one of his lawyers did, and they had to address and one of the most jarring aspects of the entire case, that 22 women have come forward with accusations.
Yeah, the question posed on the latest edition of HBO Real Sports to one of Deshaun Watson's attorneys was, how are we supposed to believe one individual, this quarterback, who, by the way, signed the richest deal in NFL history a few weeks ago, how are we supposed to believe that person against 22 accusers? Well, the answer that came out of Deshaun Watson's camp and his attorney was that, yes, these are 22 women, but it's only one lawyer. And in fact, the one lawyer took the case after two or three other lawyers turned these alleged victims down, and that this new lawyer, who is currently representing the 22, only took the case, of course, to promote his social media and to solicit these cases. I thought that was an interesting take. You know, it kind of brings to mind the bigger picture question, and it's, Dina, the same question I think we're wrestling with in the Amber Heard situation is, you know, these things seem to go up and down. You know, initially at the beginning of the Me Too movement, there was a absolute belief from day one in the allegations of the victims of sexual, emotional, physical abuse. It seems to have turned a little bit where you don't automatically believe the accusers. Certainly in the Amber Heard situation, it seems unfortunate, in my opinion, that there's such universal derision for someone who is getting up in front of the public and telling the world that I was physically, emotionally, sexually abused. Similarly, in the Deshaun Watson case, we've got 22 women who tell, you know, fairly similar stories of abuse in, you know, massage rooms by Deshaun Watson. Yet, you know, his attorney, understandably, she's doing her job, but is basically blaming the accuser, blaming the victims. What do you think of that strategy?
It seemed like a novel strategy. I am a lawyer on social media law, and that's funny. I've never heard of that being accused. I mean, Gloria Allred has been doing this forever, and nobody has accused her of that. But I think that if that were to be true, I mean, first of all, 22 victims is huge. I mean, that's even more than really we saw with Harvey Weinstein or Bill Cosby, and certainly more than with Johnny Depp. So that's quite a lot. And it's something that could very easily be revealed, because if he were indeed trying to solicit people, then theoretically he would have had to solicit 100 people in order to get 22 people. I mean, did he solicit the exact right people? So that would be one thing. And then two, if they really were kind of all fake, that would so easily come out in some sort of preliminary hearing. It'd be very hard to get 22 people to tell their stories correctly under oath if they were not telling the truth. So to me, that was just like a dart you put in the to see doubt, but didn't really have any validity.
And you always, you know, wonder, and Jeremy, I want to bring you on this. You always wonder the age-old defense of, well, these people are looking for their 50 minutes of fame. I mean, what victim of, you know, alleged victim is going to be seeking fame? And like, they're massage therapists. Do they really think that they're, I mean, to believe Deshaun Watson, you have to believe that they would, they're concocting this plan to further develop their careers as massage therapist, or what? Maybe they'll, you know, they'll get some kind of endorsement. It's, in my opinion, wacky. But Jeremy, this is in your wheelhouse, of course. The NFL has responded, and the owner of the Browns has responded that they vetted this quarterback, Deshaun Watson, more than any other decision in their history. But as this story revealed, they didn't speak to these victims. You would think at least that if part of your allegation is that you were vetting the, you know, vetting it more than you have in any decision you've ever made as a professional football club, I don't know, you might speak to the actual alleged victims to determine how credible they are before showering the richest contract in NFL history on this quarterback.
Right. Look, it's such an important question. And I think it goes to, you know, really looking at the NFL and how they handle, you know, situations in general. To me, I was surprised that, that Deshaun had gotten the contract based on the prior history of the NFL, particularly what they learned from Ray Rice and what they learned from, Deflategate and all the different, I guess issues and disputes that they've had. And the reason why I bring up those two particular references is Ray Rice basically taught us that, you know, if you're going to discipline, you know, somebody, you know, you need to do it the right the first time, essentially, and you need to take care of it or otherwise it comes back to haunt you. And then with Deflategate, I think people questioned why so many resources were put into that. You know, eventually from the standpoint of what the evidence showed or what have you. I will say this from the NFL standpoint, from the Brown standpoint, it is disappointing they didn't interview the victims or the alleged victims. But I would say that from the NFL usually does a pretty good job of sort of doing investigations. And to me, I don't think that the Browns or the NFL would put forward with such a large contract and take that risk without having done some research on this. That being said, it's a risky proposition, and you know, say what you will about the ongoing case. It, you know, to me, it was a highly risky proposition, knowing that these cases were still out there.
It's also just a rough look, right? From a PR perspective, from a league that's coming off so many scandals involving this particular these particular allegations, and trying to be more inclusive and diverse and involving women. That all goes out the window. It's apparently is the message when you have a great quarterback physically, skill level, who you could throw money at. All that stuff goes out the window seemingly when you've got, you know, the ability to advance your play on the field. It's a rough look for the NFL, I think, for sure. Joe?
Yeah, Rich, let's move on to the 2008 murder trial that's been circulating the Portland headlines for quite some time now, involving a romance novelist.
And Nancy Brophy was just convicted last week of killing her husband. Her husband was a prominent chef, and she was found guilty of second-degree murder by a jury. Oddly enough, one of the essays she wrote was entitled, "How to Murder Your Husband." Go figure that someone who wrote a novel called How to Murder Your Husband was convicted of, I don't know, murdering your husband. You know, what's interesting here is that the jury didn't know that directly. There was some reference to, I think, it, but the judge did not let that in because the essay was written in 2011, and the judge out in Oregon said that the minimal probative value of the article written that long ago was outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice and confusion of the issues. I don't know. I mean, I get the idea that it was written so long before the murder, but listen to what someone says they're going to do. That's a pretty good predictor of what they might do in the future, right?
Yeah. You know, I think that's such an interesting question because, and a good one. I think probably that the judge in the case essentially thought that that evidence would be far too prejudicial. You know, if you were to introduce, you know, this letter, this book, you know, this article basically saying how to, it'd be like, I guess to put it in context, it'd be like if O.J. Simpson wrote his book about how to murder your wife prior to the trial.
Right.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's just, I think it'd be extremely prejudicial. It is interesting. And again, the jury from a knowledge standpoint probably knows this, but again, they're going to be instructed, you know, or they were instructed to, you know, to not consider that. And it looks like it was a guilty verdict anyway.
Yeah. Dina, good decision by the judge.
Yes, definitely. Especially because she's a fiction writer. I mean, if she had just written that in her journal or she had sent that letter to somebody, I think that that may have come in as more probative. But the fact is her whole job is to spin tales. And she wrote about a lot of things. And so I definitely think that, you know, reading something like that, How to Kill Your Husband, would have been so extremely prejudicial. And the fact that she wrote it years before, and the fact that that is her job, is to write fiction. I think the judge definitely made the right call, but she was convicted anyway. So, you know, that's interesting. It showed that there was quite enough evidence otherwise.
Yeah.
From spinning tales to spinning records, it's been a while since we brought up Kanye West on this show, Rich, but he has now lost his fourth divorce lawyer.
What a shock, Dina, that Kanye is difficult to work with. He's a difficult client. This latest attorney filed a motion last week to be relieved of counsel. Samantha Spector said that there has been an irreconcilable breakdown in the attorney-client relationship. As Joe mentioned, we've covered extensively the long legal history of Kanye West. Of course, now he's getting divorced from Kim Kardashian. And, you know, also interestingly, and this lines up with a story we covered last week, or last episode, you can look to some of his lyrics. He's actually talking about some of these custody issues in his lyrics. And this seems to be a trend, by the way, talking about, you know, self-incriminating and maybe the line between fiction and nonfiction blurring in our other story. He is writing lyrics that say, wait, when you see the kids, I'll see y'all tomorrow. Wait, when the sunset, he says that the kids are being barcode scanned when they're being dropped off. So I don't envy any attorney. Of course, it's great billable hours, and we'll talk about the billable rate here in a moment, but great money to be made off this case, but a very challenging client, you would imagine, right, Dina?
Yes, very challenging. I mean, just the public, what we know from the public perception, he's very challenging. But it is true that divorces by nature are very contentious. And in Hollywood and LA, I'm sure that divorce lawyers have dealt with very contentious celebrities who don't maybe want to be treated like the average person. So for him to go through that many attorneys, I think is pretty shocking. My guess is that he doesn't want to cooperate and continue the settlement. I mean, that's what we've gotten with, you know, his, like you said, his lyrics. We've kind of gotten that he doesn't want to have this divorce. My guess is they're saying to him, okay, this is the next step. We have to respond or we have to file. And he's just refusing to do so. I mean, that is just my guess, but that would be probably the reason why a lawyer would have to withdraw, is if they literally cannot do their job because he's not cooperating.
And really quickly, Jeremy, I know that, you know, this is also in your wheelhouse, of course, as it is Dina's, but, you know, it's not easy for a celebrity that, with the stature of Kanye West, who of course is, you know, one of the most recognizable and celebrated and accomplished musicians of the last, let's say, 25 years. Not easy for him to take direction. He's used to being the one who gives direction, who tells everyone what to do. And in this case, it's likely that these four attorneys told him news that he doesn't want to hear. And we know Kanye West is, let's call him, a little bit volatile. It's probably difficult for him to take direction from his attorney, right? That's what at least we could read into the tea leaves here.
Yeah, you know, and I love what Dina said, and I think, you know, ultimately, this is where the client interview becomes so important, right? So like I go through a checklist before I bring on a client and I sort of look at what's the personality, what's the past, what's the history, what's the conversation like, you know, is it a good conversation? And then you can kind of really get into somebody's personality. And I think as an attorney, one of the best skills you can have is picking up on people's personalities and reading people and seeing what they're like. And then the second best thing is to make sure your retainer agreement essentially lines out some sort of limited scope or ways to get out of the agreement. But as Dina mentioned, you know, it's that may become difficult, especially in your middle of a case or middle of a trial. But again, I just highlight the importance of the client interview. I mean, this is you know, I think lawyering 101.
Joe, only to be a fly on the wall on the Kanye West client interview, right?
I don't know which one I would rather be, the Johnny Depp Amber Heard. I guess all that is going out publicly, though, so you could follow it along if you wanted to. But yeah, I would love to see what Kanye West is like behind closed doors, but probably only once. I don't know if I would want to see it more than once. Let's get to those fair hourly billing rates, as you were mentioning earlier. Our show director, Joey Christopoulos, was saying how he wanted to get a raise to $2,500 an hour, only because he saw it fair enough, just like a big law partner, Rich.
Almost what we're paying you guys for helping us out on Legal Face-Off. But Hogan Lovells is the law firm. And, I mean, we've tried to get this attorney, Neil Katyal, on the show many times. He's way too busy actually billing $2,500 an hour to come on. But, listen, he's one of the most accomplished attorneys in the country. He's a former U.S. acting solicitor general, which means he argued cases on behalf of the federal government at the Supreme Court. That being said, the issue here is whether his $24.65 an hour is a fair rate in this Johnson & Johnson bankruptcy case. The last record, I think, Dina, was somewhere under 2,000. I think the previous record was maybe 1,875 at Scannon Arps, but $2,000 an hour, again, there's some incredibly talented lawyers in the country, and this gentleman, of course, is at the top of that, but lots of money being billed here by attorneys.
Well, absolutely. And I started my career at a big private law firm. And yeah, I mean, this was like 20 years ago and partners were, one of the partners was billing $1,000 an hour. So to me, it seems like, okay, 20 years later, a little bit of inflation, 2,500. It doesn't even give me sticker shock. I mean, the fact is that lawyer is not doing most of the legal work when he's involved in a case or a corporate transaction. They're not doing, you know, they're passing that down to the cheaper lawyers, but they're there to make those really big decisions. And they're usually making the decisions that make or break the company decisions where millions of dollars are at risk. And at that point, a client is definitely willing to spend the $2,500 an hour to get their insight to avoid really big payouts. It's in those contexts that lawyers can make that much in a billable rate.
Jeremy, we know you're getting close to that. You're almost at the $2,500 hourly rate, but it wouldn't surprise you that based on the most recent study looking at hourly rates, the states with the highest average rates are your DCs, your New Yorks, your California, where you are. Any guess on what the lowest average rate is by state? Which state has the lowest average billable rates? Anyone want to guess?
Mississippi.
Mississippi is in the lowest 10, but it's not the lowest one. Dina, you got a guess on that?
That's a really good question. How about Florida? Because there's probably a lot of lawyers there. Maybe bringing the rate down?
It's not Florida. Joe, any guesses on the lowest rate? What the worst state to choose if you're an aspiring young lawyer and you want to make your bones on an hourly rate? What about you, Joe?
How about Montana?
Nah, you're close. Montana, the average rate was 196, but West Virginia is at the bottom of the 50 states at 166, although it was up in the last year by 4.8%. But yeah, my clients who are listening to this podcast, I know there's many, just stay tuned because in the wake of this, I'm going to be, of course, raising my rates to closer to this new standard of 2,500. So be aware.
Well, this next and our last story kind of reminds me of the situation where somebody purchased an old frame from a garage sale and then they found one of the original copies of the Declaration of Independence below it. But the dress that Judy Garland wore in The Wizard of Oz from a shoebox in a school went on auction, and then someone who felt that they were the right owner of the dress got involved.
I mean, yeah, it's like it's almost a perfect trust of the state's law school exam, but it actually really happened in real life. You know, I was trying to think as I was preparing for the story, like, it's got to be a top 10 movie prop of all time. What's more iconic than the Dorothy dress? I mean, the red slippers are, of course, iconic, too. They're in the new Academy Museum there in L.A. Yeah, but this
maybe
is a
Indiana
really
Jones hat or something.
Indiana Jones, for sure. But yeah, this is a huge piece of memorabilia. And the dispute here is whether it's owned by 81-year-old Barbara Ann Hartke, who has filed a lawsuit to stop the auction. Catholic University is a private university, and they found themselves, as you mentioned, in possession of one of the two remaining costumes worn by Judy Garland in the film. One of them was in the school, not where you would expect to find this iconic dress, of course. They got it appraised, and the number came back between $800,000 and $1.2 million. Well, guess what? Father Gilbert Hartke, who was the late uncle of the plaintiff, he ran the school's drama department at Catholic University, and he said that this was a gift to the school and not a personal gift. And more to the point, he said that as a Dominican school, they cannot accept gifts. As part of his, as a Dominican, he has to take a poverty vow, and he cannot accept gifts. So that is the argument that the university is putting forth and saying that this is our property, not your personal property. The 81-year-old niece finds or is taking a different perspective. This is not the first time, Jeremy and Dina, we've covered stories like this where people are fighting over estates and important pieces of memorabilia. What are your thoughts, Jeremy, first on this one? Who should get the dress?
You know, I think it's interesting the university is using, this idea of being a Dominican and what that means for, you know, like from like a religious standpoint. You know, religion is something that these are rules and edicts that are passed down by the church and by the leaders of the church, right? And then ultimately by God. But I think it's interesting that the university would use this from a standpoint of, because at the end of the day, it's a personal choice whether the father decided to follow that edict or not. So I don't know if it's that strong of an argument. It's an interesting one. And as Dina said earlier, maybe it's a novel one, but I'm curious how this is gonna play out.
Dina, we all know the old legal adage that possession is nine tenths or whatever of the law. The university is in possession of it, but her attorneys have said that there's no. I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of this comes down to contract law, right? Is there an agreement in writing, and if not, is there some kind of oral agreement of who owns the dress? The plaintiff's argument is that there is no such agreement, therefore it belongs to the estate.
Well, and that's a little bit of what's the problem here is it was so long ago. I don't know if the person who facilitated giving it to this priest is still alive, because that would be really important if it was this verbal agreement. So if that's not the case, they're going to have to piece it together with more like circumstantial evidence. There, I guess, was a newspaper around the time that made it implied that the school was the person receiving the gift. And that nobody came out and said that wasn't the case or anything like that. That helps the school. And the fact that when he passed away, nobody at that point tried to facilitate giving it to his heirs, which you would do if you thought it was a gift. Or maybe he would have done, you know, in some sort of will or paper or verbal request to somebody. So, you know, lacking probably enough people who actually remember what happened at the time, those kind of circumstances, I would say, gives the school a little bit of an edge here.
We like to end each show, Joe, with an around the horn segment. Let's talk about Wizard of Oz, one of the most iconic films of all time. When I was a kid, I was scared. The flying monkeys scared the crap out of me. Let's go around the horn and tell us, each of you, what your favorite character is in The Wizard of Oz. Joe, let's start with you, because I know you're a huge Oz fan.
Well, you know what's funny is my grandmother was, and my wife is too. And actually, my dad used to say the first time he ever got scared about watching something on TV is when the lion busted through the window. Right. So when you brought that up about the flying monkeys, that's what it reminded me of. I'll go with the Scarecrow, favorite character.
All right, Dina, favorite character from Wizard of Oz?
Has to be Dorothy, for sure.
There you go. Maybe you could buy the dress at auction and like Kim Kardashian did with the Maryland dress. Maybe you could see if you could, you know, fit into the Dorothy dress. Right. Jeremy, favorite Wizard of Oz character.
I'm going to agree with Dina and go with Dorothy. And I'm going to go with Dorothy because she had the most courage amongst the group. I felt like the other ones were somewhat, you know, one guy didn't have enough oil. Another guy didn't have enough courage. You know? So I think I think probably Dorothy is my favorite and most memorable.
See, I'm a big fan of horror movies, and I always side with the villains, and I'm a big fan of the Wicked Witch of the West. I thought she got a raw deal and very misunderstood. You know, you try going around with green skin and see if that doesn't affect, you know, your persona and your demeanor. So long live the witch.
Well, more good witches here than bad witches, even though Rich sides with the Wicked Witch of the East. That's going to do it for the Legal Grab Bag segment here on the Legal Face-Off podcast. Big thanks to Dina and Jeremy. Again, feel free to follow, listen, and like Jeremy Evans' podcast, the host in Believe in Sports Law with Jeremy Evans, and also follow Dina Dahl on TikTok at Ask Dina Dahl. For Rich Lenkoff and for our producers of Joey Christopoulos, Ben Anderson, and Yvonne Barbosa, I'm Joe Brand. We'll talk to you next time here on the Legal Face-Off podcast.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...